we'll see there from the paragraph thing, to verify whether the steps are taken, verify any information, review the physical security assessment, verify compliance, and compile a report. So there's no actual searching of the premises. So we submit that this is a necessary function to make sure that the security measures are in place and that the person in control is not lagging behind on those, and we will submit that the consent of the person is therefore not really necessary. In practice, how this works is that an appointment is normally made with at the present moment. An appointment is made with the owner of the national key point, and the inspector will then do the inspection. So I think this clause as it is there reflects the present situation, and we don't think that it's necessary to change that.
Ever in the past a case where an owner objected to the declaration of a property as a national key point?
Chairperson, no, because the owner or the person in control will be the person applying to be declared as a national key point. So it's highly, I do not know of a single case where the minister under the current regime just declared a national key point without the owner having applied for it in the first place.
Honourable Kola Barnard and then Honourable Shlongwe and Honourable Mbele. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to know if, and it says here that the commissioner, police commissioner, would designate certain police officials as the inspectors. What about the vetting of these officials? We're being very strong on vetting of everyone else, but I don't see anything in relation to the vetting of these particular inspectors. I just want to make sure that there are actually sufficient inspectors who are designated. We're seeing designated firearm officers taken off duty constantly. The public arrive, the doors locked, they're off doing other duties. I would hate to see this again trip over mere appointments of already highly stressed and overworked people, because it's happening with the firearms, so I don't want to see it happening here. Is there some way we can make sure that that there are sufficient? It's no good appointing one per province or two. Where they're going to get a car from? Then they'll say the station doesn't have any vehicles. So there are too many ifs, buts, and maybes. They might be able to do the job, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. Honourable Shlongo.
Thanks, Chairperson. My only worry here, Chairperson, is that there is clear emphasis that the inspector will report such compliance to the National Commissioner and nobody else. Now, I am worried about then the role of the council, and what if then there is complete breach and cover-up, which we normally see taking place within or amongst the bureaucrats. When wrong things are happening, endangering the interests of the country, only to find that the people that we say are running an oversight over this, like the council, the inspector cannot actually divulge, because that is an only preserve of the National Commission. I think something must be done there in order to ensure transparency and total control, so that we don't get these shenanigans taking place where people use this thing for criminality. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Chair, I'm actually covered now. Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Brigadier, responses to that input? Thank you.
Yes, Chair, I think with regards to the first question, there is no provision in the Act itself for vetting, and I'm sure the committee will guide us in that regard, whether there should be a qualification, if you want, for vetting of these inspectors. The Division Protection and Security Services have representatives or officers in each province. How this works is normally that there will be inspectors at provincial level who inspect these national key points at the moment on a regular basis, but the local police station is also involved in the planning committee for that national key point. So there is a second safeguard that the national key point and the police station in the precinct have a relationship that must be built. So I think the inspectors, the vetting of the inspectors, I agree there should be some form of vetting. I hope the committee will guide us on whether we should include this in the Act or maybe in terms of our internal instructions. But certainly that's a very good point. With regards to the second question, I quickly scanned the reporting process of the National Commissioner, and I agree there should be some form of reporting by the National Commissioner to the Council, so the drafting team will consider that proposal for inclusion in Clause 9 as one of the functions of the National Commissioner.
Thank you, Brigadier. Honourable Kota Bonnard, you indicated the follow-up. Thank you.
The National Police Commissioner was telling us about the lifestyle audits that will begin from the top and work their way down. But it strikes me that these inspectors are prime targets for a terrorist, for example. You know what? Just give me the blueprint and I'll give you a vehicle, I'll give you a whatever. So I don't know, but I think that, you know, the vetting and even the lifestyle audit, regular lifestyle audits once a year or something, need to take place because they have to be watched very carefully because they are the key to knowledge of these places that should be so carefully protected. And that would be the weak link, frankly, in the whole system. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the issue of vetting, you know, is something that we can look at, you know, and I think within the regulations or in the Act, that's quite important. Yeah. I don't know how other members feel. Agreement? Yeah. Right.
Just a brief response. These inspectors normally only deal with the security measures per se, not with the internal workings of the national key point. If, for instance, we look at a key point like Coburg, the inspector wouldn't even come close to the operational part thereof. So at least I think that's one form of safeguard, that our inspectors only look at the physical security measures at the critical infrastructure.
Right, so I think the drafting team must look at the vetting issue. I think it's important because the dilemma is sometimes leakages, not necessarily at it's a mid-level and lower level. Lower level officials are always an easy target due to possible financial gain and so on. So we must look at that. Thank you for that, honourable members. The next one, welcome to Honourable Molobatsi. We know Cape Town traffic is tough. The last block on that page, 11.1, inspection of privately owned property declared as private infrastructure should be conducted after the owner gives consent. Inspectors may issue. Oh, we already dealt with that. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. We move on to page 8. And the first block, 11.3b, inclusion and deletion of sanctions. The submission was working on a previous draft as the proposals do not refer to sections in the current bill, so we can scrap that. That's not really applicable. Thank you for that. Then 11.9, clause incorrectly refers to subsection 7 and not 8. It's 11.9. Can we just maybe get clarification on that? Thank you, Brigadier.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I think it was the Catholic Bishops' Conference who picked this up, and it is indeed a mistake which will be corrected. We've already noted that.
So it's important to go to church on Sundays. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thanks a lot. All right. We move on. 12 clause 12.3. How will security clearances from the SIA be ensured for public and private sector members serving on ad hoc or standing committees? Will members be subjected to a confidentiality clause? The response, section 202A of the National Strategic Intelligence Act 39 of 1994, assigns this function to the SSA. However, as the committee is aware, the SAPS also performs functions of vetting. Thank you, Brigadier.
Yes, Chair, I think that the issue in the comments was that SSA will possibly not be able to deal with the volume of the vetting applications, and whether or why the police cannot do these the vetting or perform the vetting functions. So the response from the department just referred to Section 2A of the National Strategic Intelligence Act, and this function is assigned exclusively to SSA. The SAPS may perform vetting functions internally for our own members. We are not, in terms of the Act, allowed to do vetting for external persons or bodies.
Thank you. Comments from members? Right, I think there's no major issue with that then. We move to clause 12.4. An ad hoc or standing committee can consist of only one member and can be from the public or private sector. Will members of ad hoc or standing committee or working groups be remunerated? In many cases, the ad hoc committees will not necessarily be involved in work that requires security clearance. It's also not envisaged that private sector experts need to be employed and remunerated, and therefore it will not be an issue. Thank you, Brigadier.
Thank you, Chairperson. These ad hoc committees will normally be formed from the Joint Planning Committee at the Critical Infrastructure and will include members of that committee, and they are obviously either vetted or signed a confidentiality agreement. With regards to the single member committees, the proposal will be to amend subclause 4 to read: the National Commissioner must designate a police official who is a member of a committee or working group as chairperson thereof. So it takes away any doubt that there will be this one-man committee floating around. I think that could only be dangerous. So we decided just to change the wording to reflect that.
But I mean, in terms of normal corporate practice, I mean, any committee or subcommittee, their reports will have to be ratified by the board. So, I mean, there is also, from a governance point of view, at least that second line of scrutiny and defense.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely, mm-hmm. Chairperson. And in the regulation clause 27, there is provision that the minister may make regulations about the functions and the functioning of these committees. In other words, their procedures.
Miss, are you happy with that? Then we move on. Clause 12.8. Clarity should be sought on the inclusion of the Cyber Response Committee, a mandatory standing committee to advise the National Commissioner. The Cyber Response Committee is created in terms of the cyber crimes and cyber security bill and is therefore not answerable to the National Commissioner. The intent is to create a link between the Council and the Cyber Crimes Bill. I think we also discussed it yesterday. Were you there?
Yes, Chair, we discussed this yesterday. I may just point out that members of the security cluster, the Reserve Bank, the Financial Intelligence Center, the police are all members of this Cyber Response Committee. So I think the link then between this and the physical infrastructure protection will be valuable for the National Commissioner as advice or guideline.
Any comments from members? Right. Right, everybody happy with that explanation? Then, 12.9, the Reserve Bank requested the insertion of a new clause 12.9 as follows. Notwithstanding the provisions of subsection 1 and 2, the National Commissioner must, in exercising any function contemplated under section 9.2 and 3, consult with the South African Reserve Bank in matters that may affect financial stability. And I think the comments, the comment is noted, and a proposal will be drafted for submission to the committee during the clause by clause deliberations. Brigadier.
Thank you, Chair. I think the main response to this is that this should not be dealt with in terms of this section, and the proposal that will be made to the committee during the clause by clause deliberations is to move this verification process, if I can call it that, to earlier in the process, so that you don't have an application that ends up with a minister and then has to go back to somebody. So, and it's also difficult, I think, for the National Commissioner to determine whether this is going to affect financial stability, for instance. So what we will propose is that where an application is made, the National Commissioner must ensure if that critical infrastructure is linked to a government department, that the head of that government department or organ of state, like the Reserve Bank, for instance, also be notified and have a report that accompanies the application, so that you get the input from the Reserve Bank when the application is lodged with the National Commissioner.
That makes sense.
I think that is a very good proposal. Excellent. So, yeah, thank you very much for that. Member, any comments from members at this stage? Then we move to the last block on page 8, power to delegate making of regulations to the National Commissioner. And then the comments is it's excluded in terms of clause 14.1. Brilliant.
Yes, Chair, I think in the comments of the comments that were submitted to the committee, there was a concern that the power to make regulations was delegated to the National Commissioner, but that is excluded in terms of 14.1, which states the Minister may by notice in the Gazette delegate any of his or her powers under this Act to the National Commissioner, except the power conferred on the Minister by Sections 22, 23 and 27. And 27 is, of course, the regulation clause.
Thank you for that explanation. Members, any comments?
So if the National Police Commissioner is then in charge of the drawing up of the regulations, which makes a lot more sense because it's operational practice, etc., are those regulations, I've not seen it, but maybe it's there somewhere, coming back to this committee for sign-off? Because that's the kind of move that I think should be made so we can ensure that it's in line with what the agreement is in this room.
Yeah, I think we discussed it yesterday.
Yes, we did.
And it's still a matter we must give some time to reflect on. What should be the level of our involvement as a committee? Do we want to take the responsibility to approve regulations, or should we take note of it, or should it just be given to scrutinize? So we must
And while I'm about it, what is the role of the commission? Commission, board, what's it called?
Council.
Committee, council, something. Do they see the regulations? Do they have any input? Are they allowed to give any input? You're talking about all these experts pulled together to sit on a council. Is that now done without any involvement at all of theirs?
In terms of the presentation we also received yesterday, there was two options for us as a committee. So that's one thing we must maybe look at when we come back in 2 weeks' time. But let's give the Brigadier and the Advocate an opportunity to...
Chair, while they're conferring, I just want to remind you, we didn't go through the ESCOM...
No, we indicated that we will have copies.
I know, I was reading through it last night. It's quite substantial. Well, I've got a copy. I don't know how other people don't.
Yeah, I know we will after tea.
But I think we need to perhaps go through it before we progress, because there may be inputs there that are quite valuable.
Chair, with regards to the regulations, I think in order for this bill to be implemented, there must be regulations immediately. So I think the very first council will not evaluate the regulations. But in the bill itself, clause 7D specifically lists as one of the functions of the council to evaluate, monitor and review the implementation of policy and legislation related to the protection of critical infrastructure and advise the minister accordingly. So the first set of regulations will not be discussed by the council because they will not be in existence at the time, but certainly from there on all regulations will be at least reviewed by the council with the purpose of giving advice to the minister.
Honourable Kola Barnard and then Honourable Mbele.
Just from a legal perspective, are regulations somehow incorporated under policy, or the word policy or the policy legislation? Under legislation, but we don't pass regulations as part of the legislative process, so I'm not, you say they're simply included?
As I explained yesterday with a presentation, regulations are seen as delegated legislation. So it's a form of subordinate legislation, not it depends on the original legislation passed by Parliament to give the executive the powers and also basically the framework from which these regulations must be drafted. So it is a form of legislation, yes, but not necessarily passed by Parliament.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Shlom.
My chairperson, what I wanted to find out, with regard to the process drafting of the regulations, my main worry will be the question of compliance with the bill itself and the constitution. I don't want to venture into something else, which I think we will have discussion on later on, because some of the regulations that exist, you will find that they are in total breach of the rights of people in many different ways. Now, as the Brigadier says, automatically the passing of the first regulations, it won't be overseen by the council. Isn't that going to be a delegated function of this committee to actually be appraised of such regulations so that we can actually then see its compatibility with our constitution and also with the act itself, so that there is no abuse whereby people abandon the act and simply rely on regulations? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member on this one? Brigadier?
Thank you, Chairperson. Clause 27 gives a specific, very specific framework of regulations that the minister may promulgate. So the regulations cannot go beyond that, otherwise it will be ultra vires. But also, as we discussed yesterday, whether the regulations come to this committee for approval or not, we will be guided by the committee. We have no specific agenda there.
I mean, on that one, there's arguments for and against, but I think we must still reflect on it. I mean, again, the issue of separation of powers, we must just be very, very careful that we take responsibility for executive act. And, yeah. Say, for instance, those are taken on review and we have proved it. What will be the implications for the committee? then we're the founding father and mother of that regulation. So, so we must just be, I think, very, we must be careful, yes, Honourable Kalabana.
Yeah. Chair, I don't think it's a case of us needing to approve or have the level of being allowed to approve regulations. But if we never see them, we are caught unawares when suddenly something's being implemented and we have no clue what it is. So, and I agree with you, that separation of powers and the possibility that the legislation is taken on review, I'm not saying approve them, but we must at least see them so that if we do have concerns, we can just raise it directly with the minister and say, there is a brick wall coming here with this one, reconsider. It's no good us finding out a year or 6 months after the regulations are being, used in every station in the country that there's a massive problem. Then it's too late. And that, I think, would be a breach of our oversight role and mandate. So if we can find a middle way where we can see them and then we have the right to raise with the minister, look, we have a major concern here, then if he ignores our concerns and it goes to court, that's his problem. That's his problem, not our problem. We've done our job. But I think it would be an abrogation of our responsibility not to look at them, at the very least.
I mean, an option in that regard would be the constitutional, let's say, power that's given to the NA, the committees, to say it's for scrutiny, but not say approval, so for scrutiny.
There we go.
And you scrutinize it, and that's that. You can then make recommendations. That's maybe a way to deal
with
it.
That's a way around it. I'm not suggesting at all that we approve. It's not our mandate, but I think we have to look at it.
Yeah. But it's, thank you very much. Omar Marke.
Thank you, Chairperson. Under regulations, that is chapter 6, page 22, number 5, in the Act itself.
Sorry, what section is that?
Regulation chapter 6, regulation 27. The minister must table any proposed regulations in parliament for notifications before promulgation. Is that not covering what we are talking about?
Well spotted. Didn't see it.
Yeah.
We covered it.
Well, notification is not necessarily scrutiny.
Yes, scrutiny. I was going to say, should that word scrutiny be put
but
in there?
But we must think about it.
Because that, again, is just telling you, this is what I'm doing.
I'm advised here from the left corner that notification and scrutiny bears the same meaning, but we can include scrutiny there.
Yeah, it doesn't in my dictionary.
Yeah, so it's
a legal term.
Yeah, scrutiny is not a problem. I think to amend it to read scrutiny will enhance that.
It has a very different flavour.
Let's think about it. I mean, when we go clause to clause, we can finalise that. But I mean, it's up to our advisors there to give us also the technical guidance. But thank you, members, for that. Members, we move on to page 9. The block at the top of the page, 16, it says that the clause is broad and vague. Impact in services rendered by clinics, universities, and then the department indicated clause 16.2b defines the limitations applicable to the declaration of CI. I think it's an issue that we've discussed numerous times, but Brigadier?
Yes, Chairperson. I think the confusion is between the concepts of infrastructure, what is infrastructure and what is critical infrastructure. Infrastructure is quite broad, but clause 16.2 limits that to a large extent, because it's the minister has to take certain things into account, and then 2b, the factors set out in clause 17, and remember clause 16.2 reads the minister must have regard to those factors, and the factors in 17 are quite clear, because it revolves around the strategic importance, the risk category, the resources available to the person, the effects on or the risk of a destruction, size and location of any population at risk. So this is obviously not aimed at declaring schools and clinics, etc., as critical infrastructure. What is at stake here is the security of infrastructure that delivers either a service to the basic public service to the public, or renders an important government function, like, for instance, Parliament, would certainly fall under that heading. So I think to say that Clause 16 is broad, we don't agree with that.
Colleagues?
Yeah, Chair, the call was that the CIC it makes the final determination. I think because so many entities were declared national key points that perhaps shouldn't have been, there was a lot of interference from various factions of that shouldn't have been involved, having a clear-cut group of people who determined this would be, if it was blown up or removed in some way, would have a massive impact on the citizenry, without any political interference, that would go far to bolster the public confidence in this entity. And I also note that in that list of what the minister will consider, and I think there should be, the input from the local MEC or provincial department. And I know that will be discussed now, but I think it needs to be on that list. It needs to be put in because they're the ones who are going to have to pay, you know, if it's on their property portfolio. They've got to pay the bills, and the least they should be able to do is give input and say, absolutely we agree or absolutely we disagree for this and this and this reason.
Thank you, Honourable Coda Barnard. Brigadier?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. This is specifically the reason why we want to build the consultation process into the application process. So whenever an application is lodged, that those who are concerned with this infrastructure, that they have been consulted already and signed off in the broad sense of the word on the application, so that you don't have a situation where infrastructure is declared critical and then somebody finds out that they have to pay the costs. I think the Gautrain Management Agency submission to the committee clearly demonstrated that type of danger where one party can apply and then another party is possibly in for the costs. So the proposal will be made to amend the application process to include that type of information. And just to give you an idea, one of the first drafts of this is that the relevant head of a government department in control of infrastructure must be made aware of it. The National Commissioner must require of the person in control of that infrastructure to submit a report by the head of government department or head of an organ of state who has functional control over the sector in which the activities of the infrastructure falls regarding the application, and then disclose the particulars of persons other than the applicant who has a right or interest, particulars of any agreement with a person contemplated in paragraph A that would cover the concessionaire agreement, particulars of any person other than the applicant who will be responsible for the costs of securing the infrastructure in question, particulars of any agreement with a person contemplated in C regarding the costs of securing the infrastructure in question, that refers to the person who will be paying it, and any other information necessary for the proper consideration of the application. So I think that covers to a large extent the concerns of many of the submissions that were made in that regard.
Thank you, Brigadier. Honourable Coda Barnard.
Yeah, I see how that absolutely would allay fears on each application, but does it not take us back to the core to put this down as a Section 76 so that the provinces are consulted at the outset rather than waiting for applications to come through, that they're actually part of the process.
We're still waiting for the legal opinion. But let's give the Brigadier an opportunity.
Yes, Chair, the Section 76 issue is, of course, way above my pay grade, but I can just mention that the provincial government, for instance, would be involved in such an application as the applicant. It will therefore not be costs that they must suddenly pay because someone else applied. The applicant applies to have the infrastructure declared critical infrastructure. So this is not a function that the minister can do on his or her own.
You see, what I see there is that's only if the province has made the application. But we're seeing here the minister, as it currently stands, is the one who makes the application. So he can determine in Limpopo or wherever that's going to be critical infrastructure, and that has nothing to do with the province. They've just been informed, oh, by the way, we're doing this. So the dynamic is quite different to a province saying we wish our legislature or whatever to be declared, and the minister saying this entity here is going to be, and you will pick up all the costs because I say so. That's quite a different dynamic. They may be somehow peripherally involved in that case, but they're not making the application. So I think it's from a different side altogether.
Any other member? Yes, Brigadier. Yes, Chair, with respect, I think the Honourable Member didn't get the application process, and I say this with the greatest respect. The Minister cannot lodge an application on behalf of someone else. In the current format, the National Commissioner may lodge an application after consulting with the necessary persons. But as I indicated before, the idea is that we will limit this to national government departments. The National Commissioner won't be able to apply on behalf of anyone in a province or any private entity. Clause 19 was a bit wide, and it could give the impression that the National Commissioner may apply on a private entity's behalf or on a provincial government's behalf. But when that is limited, the only person who can be declared is a national department when the National Commissioner applies, or any other applicant.
Is there anything in there that perhaps I've missed, that, and thank you for that, and you don't have to be, with due respect, if I say something stupid, it's just stupid, is there anything that protects the National Police Commissioner from, I mean, what does he do if he's instructed by the Minister to declare something that actually is not on his list? What protection is there for him from such political interference?
With a new draft of the clause that we envisage, Chairperson, the National Commissioner may only apply on behalf of national government departments. Whether the Minister instructs the National Commissioner or not, the bill does not allow for that.
Now I'm covered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to the
next
block.
Members, that deals with 16.1. The committee should seek clarity on the reasons for the advice and recommendations made by the council not stated expressly in this section, but only later in the clause through section 16.2d. The inclusion later in the clause might confuse the role of the council, and the response was the order of the sections can be considered for redrafting. President?
Yes, Chairperson, the manner in which that chapter is structured sort of represents a flowchart of logical things following logically upon each other, where the minister is first given the power to declare, then the factors that are necessary for declaration, and then the next how the application is dealt with. If that causes confusion, we can consider changing it around. But from our point of view, the process flow should rather be kept intact, because it's necessary to establish the powers of the minister before we say he can declare a critical infrastructure.
Right, members?
Honourable Bailey?
Thanks, Chair. I think is my reading of this input with regard to clause 16, sub clause 2, was that these factors and criteria that feed into the determination should are more relevant to the council process of making recommendations, because it's the council that has the expertise from government departments, from the private sector. By the time it gets to the minister, it's highly unlikely that the minister in and of him or herself would have, sort of technical or other lens to consider those factors in the final declaration. So my understanding of that input was that, subclause 2 should be about making that explicitly part of the council process in the formulation of their recommendations. And that's why it was saying that it might confuse the role of the council. So if the placement of those subclauses could be placed in the section relating to the council's functions, I think that's where the confusion will be cleared up.
Thank you very much, Alan Bailey. Brigadier Advocate, any comments on that?
The chairperson, the feeling that we have at this stage is that the minister is responsible for the decision. So one can possibly put a clause in with the council's functions to say that they must have regard to this. But this, I think if anybody is going to be taken to court, it will be the minister, and it will be on these factors. And it would probably be more confusing if it's hidden away with the council functions. So we could build in a reference clause, which I think would definitely serve the purpose that the honourable member is looking for.
Good suggestion. Yes, honourable. Much longer?
No. I think I'm a bit covered by Brigadier, because Chairperson, I'm in full agreement with honourable member. To me, I think the sequence leading to the proclamation by the minister must clearly, yes, of course, the minister is a political head, but then it will be then, to me, I don't think it will be correct that any individual must then write to the minister, then the minister on receipt of such must then make or declare that as a critical infrastructure, because that actually then isolates completely the question of the role of the council. I think there must be something that is actually then tailored in the maybe after following council recommendations to the minister, because they will have to recommend to the minister to say that yes, we see that area fit to be declared as a critical infrastructure, or we don't feel it's correct for that area to be declared as a critical infrastructure. Then the minister will make an opinion. Then the court will definitely then find the minister responsible if then that matter is challenged to court as a political head. But if I then just simply say, as Philip Mhlong, I just say, I want my house declared as a critical infrastructure, I write to the minister, then the minister, on receipt of that, simply takes a decision. If you get a hot-headed national commissioner, or can simply say, no, the act chief doesn't say that I must come to you. The act says, upon receipt of this, this is a type of action I must take. I have done exactly that. Then the council will be left as crybabies without anyone to come to their rescue.
Thank you very much, Honorable Markey.
Thank you, Chairperson. As we debate this, I tend to think that maybe if we had a copy of, or not a copy, the application for infrastructure to be declared critical infrastructure, surely I don't think you just write a letter, a love letter to the minister. I think there must be a template of some sort. And if that is the case, it means in that application form, if that is the case, a lot of these things are answered. It's not simply I'm asking for this to be declared. It will mean that you have got to fill in all of these things that are in the act in that format. So I think maybe all the time I was thinking you just write a letter. But if that is the case, then I think a lot of these things would be answered. So my question would be, by the way, such things like the application form would come with the regulation. I think that is the way it is done. But if we had a draft of that, maybe it would make us understand what actually is meant by applying. Because for me now, I was just thinking, you just write. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chairperson, but I think we need to be a bit careful because the regulation cannot supersede the act. The act will always supersede the regulation. So even only if there is no clarity in the act itself, the regulation may not actually then supersede the act itself, because the regulation is just a mere extension of the act in much more simple terms. So then that's why then I was just saying that at least there must be just government, because this council is an oversight, Chairperson. We cannot seek to weaken the oversight organ. I hear Honorable Mark. Honorable Mark is talking in a world of euphoria, whereby then you think things will be done like that. You don't know. There is no evidence that there will be such a form that will be crafted in that particular thing. So let us not rely on what is not there. Let us rely on what is before us. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that could certainly be a problem if that is correct, Honourable Mhlonga. But clause 16.1 specifically says subject to the provisions of this chapter. And then the chapter deals with a process flow. In clause 18, it says a person in control of an infrastructure may, in the prescribed manner and format, so that will then obviously be the form, lodge with a national commissioner an application contemplated in section 16.1. So the application must be lodged with a national commissioner. There will be a specific form where all these questions are asked that appear in the act. So the regulations also provide for the form and content of the types of documents that must be produced in terms of the act, or the bill rather. So the bill specifically says it must be in a certain format, setting out all these factors. It must be lodged with the national commissioner, who must give it to the council, who must then recommend to the minister.
State legal advisor.
Thanks, Chair. Just to allay the members here, Chair. One of the functions of the main functions of the council is to make recommendations to the minister, and the recommendation by the council to the minister is one of the bases upon which his decision should be made. So the minister cannot make a decision without those recommendations. If he were to ignore those recommendations, the decisions would be invalid. So that's why 16.2d says the minister must consider the recommendations of the council. So it's one of the requirements of the section.
Thank you for that. I think that explained it quite effectively. Right, thank you very much. Members, if we can move to 16.2, there was an suggestion that the council is better placed to decide in the declaration, but I think it was also raised previously, the minister's function should ultimately carry responsibility as the council is advisory, is also the executive authority. So yeah, but Brigadier.
No, Chairperson, we believe that the ultimate function should be with the minister, simply because he's the political head and the functionary. It would be difficult to imagine a situation where we have to circumscribe the powers of the council, because the council is actually the backup for the minister and to make sure that the minister applies his or her mind correctly.
Thank you for that. Then the next one, 16.2, clause should include consultation with the provincial MECs where CI falls within the provincial government's property proposal. Then the province, the response, the province in such case will be the applicant and the input will be in the application.
Yes, Chair, I think we discussed this previously. So if there are any questions coming from this.
Right, thank you. Then we move to 16.2. Parliament should play a role on the declaration of CI. What's CI? Little infrastructure. Parliament will play such a role in respect of the reports that must be submitted.
Chairperson, yes, Parliament certainly has an oversight function, which is the reason why the Minister must report on an annual basis to Parliament on the activities of the Council and set out what has been declared and what not, etc. So I think Parliament still has that function. Parliament can still call the Minister to task on these issues.
Roman 4, national security should be defined. See the comments in the definition section. Yesterday we discussed that there will be a new definition coming. So we'll await that, yes.
Yes, Chairperson, the definition will refer to the definition in the Constitution of national security.
We did this yesterday,
Any comments? Then 16.2, avoid proliferation of CI. It's very topical as well. As the bill seeks to address risk to more than pure security issues, it may happen that there will be more CI declared. However, the risk category should actually limit those CI that are in need of extreme security measures. Yes, Brigadier?
Thank you, Chair. The international trend has been to move away from protecting state security interests, if I can put it that way, to also making sure that attacks does not influence service delivery to the public, etc. So in the recent past, the national key points have also, despite the National Key Points Act, the declaration of national key points has also moved in this direction by declaring places like Eskom and Telkom, etc., national key points. So the idea will be to broaden the spectrum of the strict application of the National Key Points Act. We do not think that there will be a massive proliferation, because the factors in 17 still limits the application of the bill at the moment. And furthermore, the extreme security measures that are in place at national key points will of course also be lessened by declaring certain national key points in a low risk or medium or high risk category. So I think the bill in its current format will probably structure this whole application in a much improved way than was previously with the National Key Points Act. We don't expect a massive proliferation.
Thank you, Honourable Kalabana.
Yeah, thanks. What will be, I mean, we've had huge, huge complaints over the years of massive protection and upgrades and things to ministerial private dwellings. I understand apparently ministers live in some sort of area, walled area in houses in Cape Town, and they have the same in Pretoria. Some sort of, I'm presuming they're national key points and are given sufficient protection, etc. But I'm talking about private homes. I mean, there's nothing that I can think of where if a private home is, someone's picketing outside a private home, that has any impact whatsoever on supplying services to South Africans. So are those kind of things that have been raised over the years going to now be excluded, or are they simply going to be swept through from the national key points? Oh, yes, private homes must also be named under this new act. I'm very curious about that one.
Honourable Mark, on the same issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to clarify myself, if we say ESCOM has been declared CI, what actually are we referring to? Because it has got a Smaranyana office somewhere in a village. It has got a mobile, whatever, wherever, and it has got a power station. What are we actually referring to? Thank you.
Any other members? Right, thank you, Brigadier.
Yes, thank you, Chair. With regards to the private dwellings, I think there's a difference in the security measures that are applicable there in terms of the ministerial handbook. That must not be confused with the critical infrastructure. The critical infrastructure bill specifically speaks about the functioning or stability of the economy of the Republic, but the public interest with regard to safety and the maintenance of law and order, provision of basic public services or national security. So if by some miracle a private dwelling would fall within this description, yes, it may be declared. But from my point of view, it would really have to comply with or they will have to prove exceptional factors to be declared critical infrastructure, especially with the minister's home. I mean, the functioning or stability of the economy or public interest with regard to safety and maintenance of law and order. I don't see that. With regard to the second question, Honourable Marke, yes, it's a very good question, because certain installations of ESCOM is declared national key points, not ESCOM as a going concern. But there are questions about how do you deal with the power lines, for instance. And this bill can now distinguish between low-risk infrastructure, medium or high-risk infrastructure, because there are other infrastructure of ESCOM, for instance, Coburg or, say, Medupi or one of those power stations that may be medium or high risk. But each section of this, and when we go further in the bill, in clause 21, if I'm not mistaken, the certificate of declaration must be, yes, on page 16, 21, subclause 2. The minister must issue a certificate for each of the premises on which any such critical infrastructure forming part of a complex is located. So it will be clear, this and this and this installation is a critical infrastructure, not ESCOM as a whole.
Thank you very much. Any other members on that? Thank you for that clarification. Honourable members, then we move to 16.2. Provision should be made for the possible negative consequences of declaration. Clause 17J alludes to this. The proposed insertion is noted and a proposal will be drafted for submissions to the committee during the clause-by-clause deliberations. Brigadier?
Thank you, Chairperson. The proposal is to look at Clause 17J. And the proposal will be made during the clause-by-clause deliberations that instead of the word promote on line 40, page 14, line 40, the extent to which the declaration is critical infrastructure will promote the interest of the public, to rather replace the word promote with effect. So that covers both the positive and the negative aspects of the effect that it will have on a local community.
Thank you, Brigadier. Our
language experts on the committee.
The Oxford
Advanced Dictionary.
There you go.
Right, thanks for that, Brigadier. We moved into the next page, page 10. At the top, 16.4, the clause should be amended to delete and communications and to amend the reference to cabinet members responsible for state security. And the department said the proposal was noted and a proposal will be drafted for the committee. Brigadier?
Yes, Chairperson. During the clause by clause, we will propose that on page 13, line 56, that communications be deleted. Also on page 14, on lines 4 and 9. So within clause 16, that the word and communication, where it appears in that context, be removed. This was as a result, the word and communication was as a result of the previous draft of the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. So this will just bring it in line with that bill also.
Thank you very much, Brigadier. I think that is noted. Then we move to 17. The Council and Minister should take into consideration any public comments and submissions when processing and deciding upon designated applications. The comments is clause 18.3a provides that reports must accompany the applications. I think the Brigadier, you've already referred to it, you're welcome.
Yes, Chair, I think the comment there speaks for itself. It is already included there.
Right, members. Then 17c, the different risk categories should be defined as well as the terms on which the categories are determined. And then clause 27.1, Roman 1 provides for regulation in terms of which standards and guidelines may be regulated for. This is a dynamic operational issue that may need to be adapted from time to time. Brigadier?
Yes. Chairperson, if I may just have a moment to find the correct place in my notes. Yes, thank you, Chair. We also spoke about this yesterday, where we will propose an insertion with clause 20, a new sub-clause 7, where the minister must have regard to the prescribed system of categorizing infrastructure in a low, medium, or high risk category, and then on the horizontal axis, the probability of failure, disruption, or destruction, and on a vertical axis, the impact and consequence of failure, disruption, or destruction, so that you will have a matrix in which, in terms of which, it's quite easy to determine where the critical infrastructure will fall for purposes of a risk categorization.
Right. We move to 17D. Why are the resources available to at the disposal of the person in control of infrastructure to safeguard, repair, or replace the infrastructure be taken into consideration when declaring critical infrastructure? The comments, declaration of CI will always follow on an application. If an applicant has the required resources, the security measures can be put in place. If, however, the applicant does not have the resources to secure the CI, the physical security assessment must take that into account together with the measures that can be put in place over a period of time. Clause 24.4 provides for financial assistance. Brigadier?
Chairperson, when Clause 17D talks of or speaks of resources, one of the factors that will also form part of the application is the physical security measures that the applicant already has in place. And it is important to know whether that person will be able to comply with the current standards of the security measures that will be in terms of this bill in regulations, so that a program can be worked out to say this is the most important things to put in place now, this you can do later. But what we find in practice is that most applicants already have security measures that are far in excess of what is required by the SAPs. But I think it is important to have regard to the resources, even if it is only to refer that person to clause 24.4 to say that if you do not have the necessary monies to acquire these things, apply for financial assistance.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, this issue was raised a number of times during the public inputs, and it just does seem bizarre that a declaration by the government that an entity is critical infrastructure should be paid for by an individual or the company when they have not made the application. I understand completely if someone says, I wish to be declared, they take it upon themselves. But if it's declared by the government, you're now saying, we want your entity to be declared as critical infrastructure and we want you to pay for it. So even if they do have a certain level of security, the government may now say double it and pay it. And why should they be going asking for financial relief? The government is doing a government function and insisting on a government development, why on earth should any individual or any company be made to pay for what the government wants it to do? It doesn't make sense. And to force this kind of expense on individuals or entities when in fact they may not wish to be, in the same way that it says earlier the inspector has the right to go there and have a look even if they don't want you on the property, that speaks to people who don't wish to be critical infrastructure and who have simply been declared it willy-nilly. So there's no negotiation here. You just open your checkbook and pay. Or you have to go begging for money and ho, ho, ho. Really, I can't believe for a moment they're going to get any funding out of anybody. They're just going to suddenly find themselves in breach of some regulation that we haven't seen yet, and they're in big trouble. So there was a reason why individuals were raising this and entities are raising this over and over in the public hearings. It's absolutely bizarre to expect private individuals to pay for a government request.
No, I'm in total agreement with Honorable Colabanat. Any a place that is declared as critical infrastructure, it is because it has got value and benefit to the state. Now, how can I be, because it will mean that all these areas that are going to be declared as part of critical infrastructure, they will be found degrading. And nobody will be, you go to public works will say, no, you are not my baby. You go anywhere, you know, you are not my baby, I don't have money. I cannot actually then be a taxpayer, then also go and finance the state. That is totally unhelpful. I think there must be a clear way to say that, because this particular clause, Chairperson, it puts an obligation on an individual to say, I would understand in terms of the banks, because we want to protect the banks from being robbed. And the banks, they've got money. They are not going to say, no, we are bankrupt. They've got money. They've got to cough up something to actually, as part of partnership with the state. But you just go, because maybe somebody, let me just say, somewhere in the barren areas of the Eastern Cape, the state has got interest to preserve particularly maybe history there involved. Then are we going to say that for that particular family and their house to preserve it, it is their duty, when we say this is now a national a key point? Really, I don't really think it will make sense, because the state must be able to say we are saying that, and then it is also going to promote tourism, etc., etc. These things are also generating income for such things to be able to be, and there will be also administrative organs that will be put in place to ensure that, but not that we are just going to say, declare. We can then declare everything, you can even declare HM Chondolo somewhere, and say, no, go and fundraise, if it can go like that.
Hello, Bernard, you want the second bite?
Yeah, I just want a clarity. You did tell us that upgrades of private, like ministerial homes and deputy ministers' homes, etc., there was some work done and there were questions asked. But am I clear that that actually came under the ministerial handbook and had nothing to do with the declaration of the key point? So it's a totally different issue, although there were certain entities declared national key points that did have. But I'm hoping that will all fall away under this new one, because certainly no private homes fall into that category at all. So that was actually a parliamentary problem, was never a SAFS problem. Yeah.
Honourable Markey, you are.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I suggested last time that if we say a means test is done, because, I mean, if you own something that is important for the country, and maybe you are even gaining something from it, I wouldn't have a problem with you paying if the money is there. But if it is not there, then it clause 24.4 explains, or you will have to apply for. And that, according to me, it means some sort of a means test must be done, whether you are lying, you've got money, and you say you don't have. And if that is the case, I think I don't have a problem with that person paying. If that person can afford, is doing that for the benefit of the people. Yeah, nah. Not... What does he want? He wants to do it for himself. Whatever he's owning is for the benefit of everybody. And instead of putting all the money into his pocket, he must do something for us. But if he can afford, that I will understand. Thank you, Chairperson.
But I think, Chairperson, we need also to guard against, you know, the state is an only in any environment, because we want to build capacity of the state here. You can't say that, my honorable dog there is collecting revenue on behalf of the state, not even being delegated such a responsibility as a SARS, because they say, once, to me, I don't know, Jefferson, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, once you say, here, this is a national key point, it means we usurp some kind of powers and functions over that particular individual. We take it upon ourselves, because the state has got something of national interest. Now, even only if you take national interest and you locate it within me as the Mshongo, you need to come so kulela enjomane elungena la. If I say no, no, there is no national interest there, because that is not, to me, that is totally contrary to the goal that we want to. Once we say, if I go to, for example, to Cloudville, the Chief Lutuli's house, it's declared as a national heritage of some sort. The state has taken over responsibility. The Lutuli family in Cloudville has got no authority to say, no, the family is busy inside here doing something. As a member of the public, at any time, as long as that is in line with the administrative measures put in place, because the state has taken over powers in the running of the affairs of that institution. If now we are going to delegate national responsibility to an individual, we are going to have a problem. Serious, serious problem, I can tell you. Serious, serious problem. Because in my own house, nobody can just, even some police, I tell them, because I am the god of that family. Government cuts grass outside there, I cut grass inside there, because I'm a king of that. So you can't just come to me anywhere. So I am saying, we need to be careful. What do you do? If you say you declare this as a critical infrastructure of the state must take over responsibility of that particular thing and run with it.
Thank you, honorable members. Brigadier? Advocate, State Law Advisor.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think the research unit in the initial paper pointed out that the trend is internationally that owners of this type of infrastructure pay for their own security measures, and that it is indeed very rare for the state to pay for that. I think the main concern is that costs will be imposed on somebody who doesn't have a say in the process. But to allay that fear, once again, it is only the applicant who will be declared critical infrastructure on application. If there is a situation where one, for instance, Gautrain can apply to be declared and the costs will go to Gautrain management agency, provision has now been made in the proposed amendment that person must sign off basically on the application. All of these private entities who render a service to the state make money out of it. And they create, if they, for instance, manufacture explosives, they create a risk situation in order to sell that explosives to mines and the state, etc. So they create a risk situation in the first place, which means that they put in place security measures in any event. All of these private entities put security measures in place that are, in most of the cases, in excess of what we will prescribe to them. And they pay that gladly. But just to take this argument a bit further, in the current National Key Points Act, by the way, there is a provision like this in the bill, also in Clause 25D. Under the current National Key Points Act, the owner of a National Key Point may claim as a deduction on income tax the expenses associated with the security measures. And for the last financial year, there was only one company who claimed that rebate. Only one company. So the money really seems to not matter to the private companies, because there are a couple of them. But if the state is to, I think the main concern here, Chairperson, for the departments, is that the state will not be able to foot the bill for all the security measures at all private companies. It's, yeah, and NGOs, etc. So there are just too many holes to fill within the state to cover that as well.
Yes. I mean, provision, for instance, if a owner doesn't have the means, so that option is available in the current draft. Members? Yes, Honourable Marquet?
Chairperson, I'm thinking of, there was an explosion of a chemical, was it in India at some stage? It was horrible.
The Bhopal
incident. Bhopal. And I think it was privately owned. If you own such a thing, as the Brigadier said, you create risk on your own. You can kill people, like it happened. So why not, in fact, we must even force you to put security measures there. So there's no way in which you are making money out of that, and you create risk and you kill people. So I think it's justified. As long as they, as you said, Chairperson, as long as there's an allowance that if you can afford, then the state can come in. But if it's privately owned, you must just pay for the risk. I think it's fair now. Thank you, Chairperson.
Right, thank you.
Members, we're going to move ahead to 17K. Amend the clause to assign functions to CIC and not minister. I think we've discussed previously the minister to function in the CIC only advisory, but Brigadier?
Yeah. Chairperson, I have nothing to add.
Thank you. To the Gautrain. 18.1. The Gautrain Management Corporation requested an amendment to the section to effect that the application for declaration of infrastructure that is subjected to a public-private partnership as critical infrastructure may only be lodged by head or of an organ of state which owns, is in control of, or is responsible for the administration of that infrastructure. Following is suggested, 18.1, a person in control of any an infrastructure may in the prescribed manner and format lodge with the National Commission an application contemplated in section 16.1 to have such infrastructure declared as critical infrastructure, provided that in case of infrastructure in respect of which a concession agreement or similar arrangement exists, only the head of an organ of state that owns is in control of who is responsible for the administration of the infrastructure may lodge such an application. And the response to the department as part of the definition section addressed this. However, the committee should consider the addition of the section. Brigadier?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. We did address some of it in the definition, but as I said earlier on clause 18, we will propose an insertion 18.2 to make sure that the person who's in control of consults with all the government departments and have the report ready of that government department or organ of state. For instance, if this is a financial institution who for some reason need to do that, the Reserve Bank will have to submit a report together with the application, and the applicant will also have to disclose the particulars of others who have an interest there and others who may be responsible for the costs, as well as the agreement between them to pay, for instance, for security upgrades or something. So we didn't take the concession agreement suggestion on board, because then we would be, the committee would be legislating for one situation in the country, and that's the Gautrain GMA situation. I don't know of any other concession agreements, which is why we try to make it more general to fit in with the typical purpose of legislation.
Colleagues, any comments, observations?
Yes, I'm Bele.
Thanks, Chair. Just on that issue of reference to the definition of person in control of a critical infrastructure, and I see the Brigadier is making reference to the C parts of that definition. I'm just wondering if it would not be valuable to state explicitly that alongside critical infrastructure, we're also referring to critical infrastructure complex in the definition. Because I'm just thinking in terms of that public-private partnership context or a concessionaire context where this comes from, you're likely going to be dealing with, you know, interlinked infrastructure. So just to put it on the table outright, that it's also referring to CI complex.
To Durban Harbour, I can see you else from KZN. The example of Durban Harbour.
Yes, Chairperson, that's a very valuable input. We discussed it this morning. In fact, we haven't formulated something specifically, but when we get to the clause by clause, I think this will be a technical type of amendment, and we will make a proposal to the committee in that regard.
Thank you. We'll call it the Mbele amendment. Thank you. Thank you very much. Then we go to the next block, 19.3b. The section should state the amount of time given to a person to make a written representation to the National Commissioner after receiving a notification of the application to declare the infrastructure as critical infrastructure. Written representation in terms of clause 19.3 should accompany the application to the CIC. And the department said that this was noted and a proposal will be drafted for submission to the committee.
Yes, Chair, with the intention of redrafting clause 19 to limit the powers of the National Commissioner to only national government departments, I think the whole clause will be revisited and a proposal made in that regard. But what I can say, should this clause remain exactly the same, it is important to note that this act or this bill is still subject to the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. So this period that the person is afforded to make representations will certainly be a reasonable period.
Thank you for that. Comments, Honourable Bailey?
Chairperson, I do remember that there was an input from, I think it was Right to Know, that there was an omission in Clause 19 requiring public consultation for applications made by the National Commissioner. Now, I do understand that there's going to be a curtailment of the scope for the NPC's role to only apply on behalf of national government departments. But I think just to reflect the same process as when the person in control applies, a provision for public consultation should also be put in for those made by the National Commissioner.
Thank you. Any other member on this one? Thank you. Brigadier?
Chair, yes, that will then be known as the second Bailey amendment.
Right, thank you very much. We move then to the next one, 20. The Banking Association proposed that if the minister declares a financial institution as defined in the Financial Sector Regulation Act 9 of 2017, a critical infrastructure should be done in consultation with the Financial Stability Committee as defined in the aforementioned Act. And in the comments, banks do not, on the face of it, comply with the requirements in terms of Clause 16.2a. However, the comment is noted and the proposal will be submitted to the committee. Brigadier?
Chairperson, the proposal referred to here is the amendment of Clause 18 to include all the reports by the necessary people who have an interest in this application.
Thank you.
Any comments? Right. Thank you very much. Then we move to the study should also be offered an opportunity to make a presentation.
And then the comment supports the Gautrain Management Agency contention. This is noted and a proposal will be drafted for submission to the committee during the clause-by-clause deliberations. Brigadier?
Chairperson, this is exactly the same Clause 18 amendment that we were referring to just now.
Thank you. Then we move to 22B, the time frame of 30 days to make a submission on the property under consideration for declaration as critical infrastructure should be extended to 60 days. And then it should be kept in mind that this clause refers to the applicants. The period could be extended to 60 days.
Yes, Chairperson, this a recommendation that is referred to the person in control is actually after the application, the council will make a recommendation. That recommendation is then forwarded to the person in control to make representations. So the person in control will have lodged the application in the first place. So we didn't think that more than 30 days would be necessary, but if the committee guides us there, we don't have a problem to extend it to 60 days.
Sorry, Mr. President. You know, my worry particularly if I go back to 16, it talks of the economy, the function of the economy. I wonder whether then resumption or mobilization of such really prejudices functioning stability of the economy of the Republic. Whether that particular question might not end up being abused by certain employers who may actually want to destroy union activities and the rights of people there. I think we need to really maybe to put some safeguards with regard to that, because a person may just simply say, no, I regard this as a national key point, and, but you know, down the line, that at the end of the day, workers' rights will be curtailed and all these things, and then the excuse will be that if and only if workers go on strike, then this thing is hampering economy and all that. Yes, of course, when workers demand something for a living, then they will go on strike, and that will end by economy. Because that to me is too broad, and it falls outside in terms of even security, because I think we will be opening ourselves up unnecessarily. Because every institution that is actually or company or factory is there to make money. If workers go on strike, the economy is hampered today.
Honourable Member, do you've got a specific proposal regarding the 60 days, or you're fine with that?
Yeah, Honourable Martin.
Chairperson, the Brigadier explained something about the applicant being. If you could repeat that for me so that I can. The 60 and the 30 is important or not?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Just in terms of Honourable Mhlongo's concern, this Act does not change anything in terms of the Labour Relations Act. The Labour Relations Act will continue to protect workers and employers as it did before. Then, Honourable Markey, with regards to that 30-day period, the person in control will be the one making the application. And then the Critical Council, the Critical Infrastructure Council looks at it, gives it back to the person, and then he has 30 days to make representations on what they are going to recommend to the minister. So we thought that the 30 days is sufficient because they know the application, they made it. But if the fear is that it's not enough, we can extend it to 60 days. There's no problem with that.
Chairperson, at first, when I said I agreed with the 60 days, I thought it was referring to when the National Commissioner wants to declare the infrastructure, and this person is maybe contesting that. That is what I thought when I said 60 days. If then that is not the case, then I don't think it's necessary for the 60 days. Because I thought that is what I thought at first. But this person is contesting and he must be given time to get his facts right. But if that is not the case, he or she is the applicant, then I don't see any necessity for the 60 days. Thank you, Chairperson.
No, I agree, Chairperson. I agree, Chairperson. The 30 days referred to here will only be for those persons, and in view of the fact that we are going to curtail the application function of the National Commissioner, it will not be in terms of persons who want to oppose the application.
The Honourable Mhlongo?
No, but I hear what the Brigadier is saying, in particular with Section 16.22. A particular Roman figure, one, the functioning or stability of the economy of the Republic. I'm not really too happy about that, because really, that is definitely going to open us to unintended consequences in terms of, because remember, at the end of the day, yes, you might actually say, right, it doesn't necessarily curtail the rights of or border on actually then undermining labor relations act or whatever. But this act, because the minister has actually declared this particular area as a critical infrastructure, and then it means at the end of the day, anything that seeks to threaten economic stability must be taken into account. And then we find our people then getting the volume of security forces like what we saw in Marikal. Because Lomin is the main money maker. Now, really, I think we need to be very careful about this thing. Because to me, I don't understand. Every factory that is actually running here, even around Cape Town, as long as it's turned over, it is about some millions, maybe per month or per day. Then the owner will come and say, I want this thing declared as a critical infrastructure. Then, and this particular section applies. It's definitely, in one way or another, it's going to have an adverse effect to workers. To workers' rights, I mean.
Thank you, members. We will take a 15-minute break. 15 minutes, and we'll come back after that. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.